Aunt Lola. The gate to Aunt Lola's yard hung limp on broken hinges, closed with a piece of rope. Basilio let himself in from the alley and walked over cracked concrete to her back door. It was nearly dawn on Christmas Eve, stars fading into a gray, cloudy sky, a sea bag full of gifts on his shoulder. He paused before knocking, staring in as Lola moved around the kitchen in her housecoat, sipping coffee. She didn't hear him when he rapped lightly, so he watched a moment more, looking at post-war metal cabinets thick with brown paint and wrinkled decals of horses, an old Oriole stove, a tank without a thermostat, next to a top-of-the-line Kenmore fridge, a morning gift from Lola's kids when their father had passed away the year before. On the wall, next to a one-week-left-in-the-year calendar from Our Lady of Pompeii, a studio portrait of the original Bombacci sisters, Mary, Stella, Anna, Francesca, and Amelia, unsmiling in old country sepia before dispersal to orphanages, servants' quarters, and inevitably, America. During the Great Depression, when being poor meant nothing more than not having money, the sisters had populated the alley with children, a score of first cousins that included Basilio's father, son of Francesca, and Lola, daughter of Anna. Basilio and Lola, whom he called aunt out of respect, they were the only ones left in the 600 block of South Macon Street. The rest were dead or scattered in a grass-is-greener hopscotch that began in an alley once known for homemade wine and rose bushes, before skipping out to Dundalk and then Rosedale and White Marsh, and now out to the godforsaken, subdivided pastures of Harford County. The family would be celebrating Christmas Eve out there, all except Lola and Basilio. Lola's children had tried for a year to get her out of the house to no avail, and Basilio, who made ends meet painting pictures of seafood on the sides of refrigerated trucks and didn't own a car, sure wasn't hiking out to Falston just for dinner. Lola came to the door and pulled the curtain, her face creased with lines that he'd drawn a thousand times over. Wisps of Francesca, gentle to the point of naivete, alive on the other side of the glass. Lola squinted, recognized him, and unlocked the door as he plucked something from his bag, the satchel immediately lighter by half. "Hey, hon," said Lola. "What you doing up so early?" "Giving out presents," he said, stepping into the warmth of fresh coffee, dishwater, and oil heat, holding a heavy, long-handled cookie iron in front of her. "This one had your name on it," he said. In the long moment that Lola puzzled over the well-worn contraption, Basilio realized he hadn't been a boy for a very long time. His daughter was grown and on her own. His parents had slowed to a ritual of soup and sandwich at 2 p.m. every afternoon, no matter what day it was, and no one put out shallow, dime-store dishes of celery dribbled with olive oil and black pepper before holiday meals anymore. "What is it?" Lola asked. "What is it?" Lola felt around on top of the washing machine that stood between the door and the sink and found her eyeglasses. "Good God," she said. "I ain't seen one of them in many a year." As she poured coffee for him, Basilio opened the flat jaws of the Pizzelle iron to show what was engraved there. The miraculous medal of Our Blessed Mother on one side and a busy weave of diamonds on the other. Miraculous. A floral M in a constellation of petitions. The initial interwoven with a cross surrounded by 12 stars. 12 stars. A dozen men on the road. Sowing truth that no one wants to hear. And truth. Spare parts and broken hearts in an East Baltimore kitchen nearly 100 years after their ancestors had found warm beds, full plates, and simple work in the shadow of the great bottle cap factory. "Where'd you get it, kid?" she asked. "Where do you get anything in the third world nation of Baltimore?" said Basilio. "From some dummy who didn't know what the hell it was." He set the iron across the newspaper on the table, yesterday's headlines confirming his cynicism, and looked around the spotless row house. Catholicism a lesser devotion than prayers said on your knees with a bucket and a scrub brush. Aunt Lola didn't have a tree, but carols were playing on a plastic AM radio, and she'd taped Christmas cards to the spokes of the banister in the middle room. "What the hell am I going to do with a Pizzelle iron?" she said. "Hang it on the wall?" And just before Basilio could say that that wasn't such a bad idea, "Hang it on the wall, put up a small shelf, and light votive candles." Before he could say that, something better occurred to him. "I don't know, hon," said Aunt Lola. "How hard can it be, Aunt Lola?" "I turned many a Pizzelle iron," she said, "but one of my cousins picked up on the recipe, not me." "No one wrote it down?" "Didn't have to, so nobody did." "We can do it," he said, drumming his fingers across the plastic tablecloth. "I watched them do it. You did it every year. Eggs, sugar, flour, and butter like anything else you make." "Got plenty of sugar," she said, "but baking powder, baking soda, I don't keep that stuff around anymore." "Well, the store does," said Basilio, getting up to peek in the fridge, empty except for a small carton of milk, a jug of water, and two meatballs and a dish of tomato sauce. An expensive nightlight. "There's some vegetable oil in the cabinet," she said, "but the main thing is the anise," said Basilio. Lola moved to a roll-top hutch, Pennsylvania Dutch stenciling on the lacquered wood, and found a crusty brown medicine bottle, bone dry. "Don't let 'em give you extract. It's 2 weeks," she said, handing him the bottle. "Oil of anise, same as what you're holding there." Lola went for her change purse, but Basilio was already at the door. "Be right back," he said, picking up his sea bag on the way out the front. On the street, he counted the houses as he passed them and remembered who used to live there. Mr. Kugler, the German, who made beer in his basement, put on lederhosen to hike in Patterson Park, and was head chef at the bottle cap factory down by the railroad tracks when it employed more than 1,000 people. Miss Helen, a tough Polish lady who shucked oysters in cold packing houses on Boston Street. She worked as hard as any man and would tell you without being asked. "We didn't have no women's lib in them days. We just worked." His grandparents' house in the middle of the block, where on a Christmas Eve 40 years earlier, Basilio had lost a flying beetle doll, John. Lost him above these tarred roofs, a toy enjoyed for a moment before it disappeared into the cold night sky. And how he'd cried. Never imagining that a couple of miles down the salty river would find him living on Macon Street the way his widowed grandfather had before him, alone. 2 blocks up, he hit Eastern Avenue and turned left toward the old Chessie Underpass, built in 1930 when the factory was supplying millions upon millions of crimped, cork-lined crowns to bottlers around the world. A train rolled by as he walked beneath a trestle, and he stopped to absorb the feel of it, remembering stories of Depression-era kids being sent to pick up loose coal to throw in pot-bellied stoves, cheap coal that burned dirty, and every now and then blew up a house. The train passed, and he moved into the Highland Town shopping district, reaching into his bag to give away a baseball cap, the mighty orange cartoon bird, freshly laundered and smiling, to a boy young enough to be happy about it. He gave a repaired rosary to a Salvadoran woman pushing a stroller with 2 kids in it, and he laid a little holiday Feliciano on her, and she smiled. He unloaded everything he had in the short walk to De Pasquale's, near the corner of Gough and Conkling. Sometimes during this annual ritual of passing out unwrapped oddities that people would have stepped over if they hadn't been presented as gifts, he'd see the very thing he'd given away, a plastic action figure or a ball with a few bounces left in it, a redistribution of something more impossible than wealth. He'd see it lying in the gutter alongside the spot where he'd just offered it. At De Pasquale's, around the corner from Zanino Funeral Home where his grandfather had been laid out, Basilio ordered a double espresso from the girl behind the deli counter and drank it down. His duffel no longer a St. Nick's sack, but a grocery bag, as he grabbed what he needed. At the register, he took out the anise bottle and asked if they could refill it for him, the way Lola said they did back when you got anise at the pharmacy. Studying the bottle like an Indian arrowhead, the cashier chuckled and handed it back to him, along with a plastic bottle of anise, just as small, marked $5.95. In Basilio's wake, someone was buying ricotta and someone was getting hauled out to a hearse. On an opposite corner, Mr. Stan Schneider was selling last-minute inventory at his custom foam shop, pierced hearts and holly for the cemetery, and twinkling lights for fake trees. One goes out, and the whole string goes out. "Got it," said Basilio, walking back into Lola's house without knocking. The kitchen table was covered with wax paper, and an empty aluminum spaghetti pot sat on the counter. Aunt Lola was leaning up against the washing machine, counting on her fingers. "I think I got it, too," she said. "It'll all come back to me when I start making the dough." She cracked a half-dozen eggs into the pot and tossed everything else in after them, pouring out a couple of tablespoons of the anise oil, Basilio holding the pot steady as she leaned over it with an electric mixer, the beaters nicking the edges. And then she took a dab of the dough and fashioned a small cross from it, sticking the icon to the back of the stove where they'd see it as they worked. "My mother always did that," she said. "For luck, I guess." Basilio turned a knob on the stove and put a match to the front burner. The oven is old as the railroad underpass, bought at Bulwicki's, and in the house for years before Lola moved in on her wedding day. The iron lay over the open flame. "Good and hot," said Lola. "It's got to be good and hot." And soon she was dropping small balls of dough between the scored jaws of the iron. The first few were pale prototypes, trial and error, and an almost good one for every three that weren't right at all. "Let me try," said Lola, taking the iron and dipping under the weight of it. "My God, it's heavy." Basilio held her wrists in his hands. They were soft and pudgy like the dough, and he helped her turn the iron. They made a keeper and flipped it onto the wax paper. The cookie flat and crisp and light brown around the edges, the M of Mary raised in perfect legibility. Lola had been up since 3 that morning, and she couldn't get back to sleep, but she was tired now. "I'm going to rest my eyes a little bit," she said, moving to the couch in the front room, a crocheted pillow under her head. "Just a couple minutes." And a couple minutes was all it took for Basilio to get the ambidextrous hang of making the cookies by himself, as though the iron and the dough were brushes in his hand. Open, plop, squeeze long enough to say a Hail Mary, turn the iron, sing a verse of God Only Knows by the genius Brian, open, pluck, repeat, 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 as Aunt Lola breathed in the warm aroma, the licorice scent of the anise perfuming her dreams. Awake, we recognize and remember the mystery of more than 10,000 smells through 1,000 genes and 1,000 receptors. They come together the way letters form words, and words make sentences. Asleep, this gift multiplies, and the receptors that told Lola Pete Sells were piling up in the kitchen had bonded in her heart into the shape of a teardrop. Science promises that in the future, smell may be restored to those who've lost it, a day when appetite, fear, and longing will be given back to people unable to follow their nose. But until that day, 2 dozen Pete Sells on the kitchen table, 3 dozen, 4. As pictures moved in Lola's gray head, glimpses of the trucking company at Foster and Oldham when it was a pasture, the day when her mother unwittingly burned up the rent money by hiding it from her husband in the oven. Basilio turned the iron and stared out into the alley. Out there in the weeds and the litter and the dog crap, he saw the days when he'd be taken into small, dark bedrooms crowded with heavy furniture and crucifixes. Crucifixes large enough to be planted on Calvary, vanity tables turned to altars for sick old ladies as the Bombacci sisters fell away, one by one. He never remembered their names. He could never tell the difference between Aunt This One and Aunt That One, the room smelling of death and noxzema, as the aged brushed their hair below 3D collages of the Sacred Heart, frames of bleeding butterfly wings that scared and transfixed a boy no taller than the post at the end of the bed. "Come here, kid," they'd say in broken English. "Come here, let me look at you." For taking 5 small steps from the foot of the bed to the head with a little nudge from behind, for letting his cheek be touched, Basilio would get a quarter. Remembering what a long, hard road those 5 steps had been, he decided that when Lola woke up, they would retrace them together. and when she did, she found the table crowded with cookies, the aluminum pot rimmed with crusts of dried dough soaking in the sink. "Good Lord, how long was I sleeping?" she said, nibbling the edges of a pizzelle. "And what are we going to do with all these cookies?" "Give 'em away," said Basilio. "Sounds good to me," said Lola. "I slept good." They packaged the cookies in tins Lola found in the basement, dusty things that were once packed with Getz's caramel creams, SK sausage, and Utz potato chips, old drums that she rinsed out and layered with the last of the wax paper. As Basilio passed her stacks of cookies, Lola counted them out, 4 dozen, 5 dozen, 6 dozen. 7 dozen, she said, just like I thought we'd get from what we whipped up. She started nibbling another cookie, and Basilio picked up the phone and called for a cab. "Where we going, hon?" "Falston," he said. "Falston," said Lola, happy to take a ride. "Wait till they get a load of us. Should we call and let 'em know we're coming?" "Nah." The cab honked, and they walked out the front door. Lola with one tin and Basilio behind her with 2 more. His sea bag lay empty on the kitchen floor. The cold was sharp, and the late afternoon sky was heavy with the possibility of snow. "I dreamt the bottle cap factory was on fire," she said, as they got into the cab. "That cork burned for a week when we was kids. We didn't think they'd ever put it out." "It's going to be new again," said Basilio, telling the cabbie to ride by the factory on his way out of the neighborhood. "Just like the old American Can building over in Canton." "Canton, sure, over in Canton everything's new. But not here," said Lola. "I'm just saying, Aunt Lowell, hold on to your house. It's going to be worth a lot of money one day." "Where the hell am I going to go?" she said, a month away from her 75th birthday. "When I go, I'm going straight from here to Zanino's." The cab turned for the interstate, then traveled over the river and through the woods, pizzelles warming Lola's lap through the bottom of the tin.
Rafael Alvarez sharing his annual holiday story, Aunt Lola. Alvarez's new collection of short stories is Tales from the Holy Land. You can find him online at alvarezfiction.com.